the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us who might deceive us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
This is a big deal. When they call U.S. Supreme Court cases landmark cases, they mean they really change things. And this one does. Carson v. Macon. You might not have heard about it. We've talked about it before here on Issues, Etc. A case out of Maine that really has changed the actual law for religious schools, hopefully permanently. So what is the implication of saying, if you're going to fund private schools in your state, you need to also fund religious schools? You cannot discriminate against them just because they have a religious basis or teach religion. What's the implication for schools, private schools, and Lutheran schools, Catholic schools all around the United States? Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's rejection of Maine's ban on aid to religious schools, Michael Bendis. He's senior attorney with the Institute for Justice. He argued the case, Carson v. Macon, before the U.S. Supreme Court. Michael, welcome.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me back.
What's it like to argue a case before the Supreme Court?
Nerve-wracking is probably the best way to put it. At least the preparation and the moments leading up to the argument were incredibly stressful, nerve-wracking. You know, we did a ton of preparation for this case, and this was my first time arguing before the court, so that might have also had something to do with it. But by the time we got to the argument itself, it was strangely comfortable. I think all of that preparation and all of that worrying paid off in the sense of me just feeling a lot more comfortable in the moment itself. It was draining. It was a long argument. It was close to 2 hours. But it felt okay, and I think all that preparation on the front end paid off.
This ruling is being called a landmark case. Why so?
Well, this decision really resolved the last major constitutional cloud over school choice programs. And by school choice programs, of course, I'm talking about programs that enable parents to select a private school of their choice if they don't believe that their public school is the right fit for their child. When these programs were in their infancy, the big unresolved question was whether they were permissible under the federal constitution. School choice opponents, teachers' unions, and other organizations claimed that the federal constitution prohibited these programs, at least to the extent that they included religious options. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument back in 2002 in one of our cases, a case called Zelman versus Simmons-Harris. In fact, that decision will celebrate its 20th anniversary on Monday of this coming week. But after that decision, after it was perfectly clear that school choice is permissible under the federal constitution, the school choice opponents kind of retrained their focus and started arguing that even if the federal constitution allows these programs and allows religious choices, state law, whether it's state constitutions or state statutes, prohibit religious options in these types of programs. And that was the big unresolved question until yesterday, when the Supreme Court confronted that issue, whether a state by its own law may bar religious options from a school choice program.
What circumstances led to Carson v. Macon reaching the U.S. Supreme Court's docket?
So we filed this case back in 2018. Maine has long had a program. It's called a tuitioning program, but basically it's a school choice program for children who live in towns that don't operate a public high school. So if you live in a town without a public high school and the town doesn't contract with another school to educate the students in that town, then the town has to provide you the tuition funds that you would have otherwise been spent to educate you. And you can use those funds to attend the school of your choice. It can be a public school in another town. It can be a private school. It can be in-state. It can be out-of-state. But the one thing it can't be is religious, or the one thing it couldn't be until yesterday was religious. That's because since the early 1980s, Maine had prohibited use of this program for any school that the state deemed sectarian. So we challenged that exclusion back in 2018. While the case was making its way through the lower federal courts, we were also litigating another case involving a similar religious exclusion in a case out of Montana. And while we were in the Court of Appeals in the Maine case, that other case out of Montana reached the U.S. Supreme Court in 2020. And the Supreme Court in that decision, a case called Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue, held that Montana's exclusion of religious options from its school choice program was unconstitutional. So you're there now thinking, okay, we've got this Supreme Court decision. Clearly, the similar exclusion in Maine's program is also unconstitutional, and we win that case as well. The First Circuit Court of Appeals saw things differently, though. 4 months after the Supreme Court issued that 2020 decision out of Montana, the First Circuit actually upheld Maine's religious exclusion. And what it said was, look, the exclusion in Montana turned on the religious identity or the religious status of the excluded schools. Schools were excluded simply because they were religious. According to the First Circuit, though, Maine wasn't excluding schools because they were religious. Maine was excluding schools because they do religious stuff, like teach religion. And somehow in the First Circuit's view, this was a meaningful distinction, a constitutionally meaningful distinction. And it held that Maine's exclusion, which turned on basically whether or not the school was providing religious instruction as opposed to whether or not the school simply was religious, the First Circuit held that that exclusion was perfectly permissible. Obviously, we took issue with that holding. We asked the Supreme Court to review it. And that's how we got up to the Supreme Court. It agreed to hear the case last year, and it was argued in December of 2021.
So what religious issues were in play here in Carson v. Macon?
Sure. So, you know, as we mentioned, Maine has this exclusion. Some states have these exclusions set out in their constitution. Maine's was set out in a statute. But it basically said, you know, this program could only be used at non-sectarian schools. We argued that that state law targeting and excluding religious options violated the federal constitution. First and foremost, we argued that it violated the free exercise clause of the United States Constitution because it puts families to a choice, right? Families we know have a right to select a religious school for their child. The court has long recognized the right of parents to educate their children in private, including religious schools. We also know that parents in Maine, at least those who live in one of these tuitioning towns, have a statutory right to this money, these tuition funds, to use at the school of their choice. We argued that by conditioning the receipt of those funds on a parent's surrendering of her right to choose a religious school for her child, the state was violating the parent's free exercise rights under the First Amendment. So that was the primary argument, and, you know, as we'll probably talk about here shortly, the one that actually carried the day. But we also argued that this exclusion violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment because in order to determine whether a school is or is not religious, the government sometimes has to make these intrusive inquiries and judgments about the degree of a school's religiosity. And the First Amendment prohibits that kind of governmental intrusion into the religious affairs of an organization, of a religious organization, school, et cetera. So that was a secondary argument. And then we also argued that this provision violated the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. But again, what carried the day here was that first argument, the free exercise argument, which we'll get to here shortly.
What are Blaine Amendments?
Well, Blaine Amendments are provisions that are found in 37 state constitutions. And these provisions, roughly speaking, prohibit public funds from going to sectarian schools. Now, in order to kind of fully appreciate these things, it's important to recognize where they came from. Most of these have their origins in the mid to late 19th century, at a time when the public schools were much different than the public schools of today. The public schools in the 19th century were overtly religious, and in keeping with the kind of majority of the population in the United States at the time, they were essentially Protestant in nature. They taught from the Bible. There was, in virtually every public school, there was daily Bible reading, daily prayer, singing of hymns, but it was almost always from a Protestant perspective. And as Catholic immigration increased over the latter half of the 19th century, this became a problem because you now had Catholic kids being compelled to attend public schools that were essentially teaching Protestant tenets. There were numerous instances, actually, of Catholic kids being expelled or beaten for refusing to engage in some of these religious exercises. So Catholic parents began lobbying for better treatment in the public schools. And when that didn't work, they began demanding a share of the public school funds to operate their own schools. They basically said, look, if you're going to tax us and force our kids to attend these effectively Protestant public schools, we should be entitled to a share of those funds ourselves to establish our own schools. That went over like a lead balloon, and there was a movement at that point to amend the United States Constitution to ban public funding of so-called sectarian schools. Now, this amendment, which was proposed by a gentleman named James G. Blaine, a Speaker of the House and later Senator from the state of Maine, it would have done two things. It would have preserved the religious exercises in the public schools. So, for example, it would have preserved daily Bible reading and all of these things that had been going on, but it would have denied any public funding of so-called sectarian schools, which was understood to essentially mean the Catholic schools that were being established to educate the newly arrived Catholic immigrants. Fortunately, that amendment passed overwhelmingly in the House, but it failed by just a few votes in the Senate to get the supermajority that it would have needed to go on to the states for ratification. So that was great. But many states achieved through the back door what Blaine himself wasn't able to do from the front, which is they amended their state constitutions to include similar language to prevent public funding of so-called sectarian schools. So I apologize for the kind of historical detour here, but I think it's important to recognize that these provisions, which opponents of school choice weaponized to attack school choice programs, to argue that these programs are impermissible because they, you know, violate these state Blaine amendments, what they're really relying on are vestiges of 19th century anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant animus. And I think that's important to keep in mind when you listen to the arguments that the other side in these cases makes.
So what arguments did you make in this case?
Well, you know, the big one again was the free exercise argument, that by applying Maine's statute. So Maine, interestingly, even though Blaine himself was from Maine, Maine does not have a Blaine Amendment in its constitution, but it does have effectively the same thing in statute. So the state, as we discussed before, codified this exclusion on use of these funds for religious instruction. So we argued that that violated the free exercise clause by impermissibly conditioning the receipt of the tuition funds on the surrender of a parent's right to choose a religious school for her child. And there's a long line of cases from the Supreme Court that have held that government cannot burden free exercise rights by conditioning a benefit in that way. So, for example, there are a couple of famous cases where workers' compensation benefits or unemployment benefits, I should say, were withheld after an employee was fired for refusing to work on the Sabbath or for refusing to manufacture arms in contravention of his religious beliefs. And the court held in those cases that the state couldn't condition the receipt of the benefit on them surrendering their free exercise rights to observe their Sabbath, to not be compelled to manufacture arms, those sorts of things. So we essentially relied on that line of cases, as well as some more recent ones, to say that's exactly what Maine is doing here. Maine is providing this benefit. Our clients are statutorily entitled to that benefit, but our clients cannot get that benefit if they exercise their right to choose a religious school for their child. And government simply can't impose that kind of condition on receipt of an otherwise available benefit. That was our main argument. And again, the one that ultimately carried the day here.
How did the opposition argue?
They, I think, tried to cloud the issue in a couple of ways. The first thing that they did was they said, look, this isn't even a school choice program. They described this as providing the equivalent of a public school education. They said that, you know, this program is only available in towns that don't have a public school. And really what they're trying to do, or what we're trying to do, is ensure that kids have the equivalent of a public education. That's why we provide these funds. But as the Supreme Court yesterday held in its opinion, that doesn't quite make sense when you look at the statute itself, right? The program provides funds that can be used at the public or private school of the parent's choice. So right in the text of the statute establishing this program, it provides a choice between public and private. Any child that wants a public education can get one. They can use this benefit to attend a public school in a neighboring town. The statute also provides for private choices. And so this idea that this was simply the equivalent of a public education was belied by the very statute creating the program. And moreover, as the court explained, the private schools that do participate in this program are unlike Maine's public schools in a whole host of ways. Private schools, you know, non-religious private schools, the private schools that were until yesterday allowed to participate, did not have to follow this curriculum of the Maine public schools. They could charge tuition, and many did, to the tune of $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, which obviously public schools can't do. They don't have to hire state-certified teachers like Maine's public schools do, and the list goes on. And the court kind of cataloged these ways that the private schools that are allowed to participate in this program are wholly unlike Maine's public schools. So, but nevertheless, Maine insisted that this was simply the equivalent of a public education, and because a public education has to be non-sectarian, so too do the private schools participating in this program. But again, the court saw through that argument. The other argument that Maine tried to make was, and this goes back to the First Circuit Court of Appeals distinction between religious identity and religious use of the funds, Maine tried to argue that, you know, look, we're not excluding these schools because they are religious. We're excluding them because we don't want taxpayer funds going to religious instruction. You know, again, we're not discriminating against the school as a religious school. We're taking issue with what the school is doing. And the First Circuit Court of Appeals had bought that argument, had held that that was a constitutionally meaningful distinction. Yesterday, the Supreme Court said, no, either way, it's discrimination against religion. And either way, you're penalizing someone for exercising their religion. And as the court has consistently made clear, yes, the free exercise clause protects your right to be religious, to have a religious status or religious identity. But it also protects your right to act on those beliefs. After all, it's called the free exercise clause, and inherent in the word exercise is action, conduct, activity. And so yesterday the court flatly rejected this notion that there's a meaningful distinction to be made between discriminating against a parent based on her religious status and discriminating against a parent based on the religious use to which she would like to put her child's tuition benefit. In either case, the court said it's discrimination that turns on someone's free exercise of religion, and in either case, it's unconstitutional.
How significant is it that Chief Justice Roberts joined the Six Justice majority?
It was very significant because he has written now, this is kind of the third in a line of cases that involve these religious exclusion issues that the chief himself has written in. And I think some of those earlier cases, including that Montana case that I mentioned before, by emphasizing so much that the exclusion in those earlier cases turned on religious status as opposed to religious conduct or religious use, I think some observers thought that the Chief Justice might, like the First Circuit, think that there was a constitutionally meaningful distinction to be made between those two things. To be clear, the Chief Justice had never suggested that there was or implied that there was a distinction, but by emphasizing so much in these earlier cases the fact that the exclusions there turned on religious identity or status as opposed to conduct or use, I think some observers thought that he might well see a distinction to be made there. And yesterday, he dispelled those observers of that notion and said, look, however the state characterizes its discrimination as targeting religious status or religious use, in either way, it violates the Free Exercise Clause. So I think his not only joining the majority, but authoring the majority really answered those questions that had been kind of circulating in light of the heavy emphasis on religious status discrimination in some of those earlier cases.
How do you respond to those who are claiming that this decision somehow erases the line between church and state?
It does no such thing. This program is not a program that funds schools. Like all school choice programs, this is a program that funds families. The funds are provided so that students can attend the school of their choice. It's not a matter of government directing the funds to one school or another, or government picking the school that a child will attend. If that were the case, if government were simply saying, hey, you child are going to this private school and we'll pay for your education, but you go to this private school and guess what? This private school is religious. That would be a problem under the First Amendment. But that's not what's going on here. Government is providing funds to families and allowing them to exercise private choice over where to use them. And that private choice breaks the connection between church and state because the government, again, is not funding the schools as such. It's funding families. It would be like arguing that this is now requiring Maine to fund religious schools would be like arguing that the food stamp program is government funding grocery stores or that Medicaid is government funding hospitals. It's not. It's government funding individuals and allowing them to make the choice over where to use those funds. And again, that private choice, that independent choice of parents, breaks the link between church and state.
What does this decision mean for religious schools and for school choice in other states?
Well, this goes back to what we mentioned at the outset, that this decision really resolves the last major constitutional question surrounding school choice, whether state law can prohibit or bar programs that include religious options. And for a long time, whenever a state legislature has considered adopting a school choice program, the opponents of school choice, typically the teachers' unions and their allies, run to the state house and they tell the legislature, you cannot adopt a school choice program here because our state constitution or our state statutes prohibit funding of religious schools. And if they're not successful at defeating the program in the state house, they run to the courthouse after the program is adopted and they challenge it there. And they weaponize these Blaine amendments to attack the school choice program, to say it violates our state constitution, it's unconstitutional, or the religious schools have to be excluded, and you now have programs that are tied up in litigation for years and years and years. As you can imagine, faced with that, many legislatures who might otherwise be inclined to adopt these programs have kind of stepped back and been reluctant to do so because of all these legal uncertainties, because they're being told by the teachers' unions that if you pass this program, it will be unconstitutional and state law requires that religious schools be barred. Yesterday, that whole line of argument was put to rest, and the Supreme Court said no. The federal constitution is clear that you can have a school choice program that includes religious options. Moreover, if you have a program, religious options cannot be excluded from it. State law cannot require that religious options be expelled from the program, because that runs right into the Free Exercise Clause. And again, the Free Exercise Clause prohibits a state law that conditions the availability of a public benefit program on the surrender of someone's rights under the First Amendment.
Michael Bendis is senior attorney with the Institute for Justice. He argued the case of Carson v. Macon before the U.S. Supreme Court. You'll find a link to the Institute for Justice at issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate it.
Thursday on Issues Etc., we'll get a review of the movie Jurassic World Dominion with Pastor Ted Geese. We'll respond to your email in the Issues Etc. comment line, and we'll look forward to Sunday morning, according to the 3-year lectionary, talking with Dr. Carl Fikencher about the cost of following Jesus in Luke chapter 9. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.